Chapter 5. How to keep separate from the world. You are no part of the world. John 15:19. Paragraph 1, question. What did Jesus emphasize during his final night on earth as a human? During his final night on earth as a human, Jesus expressed deep concern for the future welfare of his followers. He even prayed about the matter, saying to his Father, "I do not request that you take them out of the world, but that you watch over them because of the wicked one. They are no part of the world, just as I am no part of the world." John 17:15-16. In this heartfelt request, Jesus showed both his deep love for his followers and the importance of his word stated earlier that night to some of them. "You are no part of the world." John 15:19. Clearly, it was of great importance to Jesus that his followers keep separate from the world. Paragraph 2, question. What is the world to which Jesus referred? The world Jesus mentioned refers to all of mankind who are alienated from God, ruled by Satan, and enslaved to the selfish, prideful spirit that emanates from him. Indeed, friendship with that world is enmity with God. James 4:4.
How, though, can all who want to remain in God's love be in the world, yet be separate from it? We will consider 5 ways. By remaining loyal to God's kingdom under Christ and neutral in worldly politics. By resisting the spirit of the world. By being modest in our dress and grooming. By keeping our life simple. And by putting on our spiritual suit of armor.
Remaining loyal and neutral. Paragraph 3, question A. How did Jesus view the politics of his day? Question B. Why can it be said that Jesus' anointed followers serve as ambassadors? Instead of participating in the politics of his day, Jesus focused on preaching about God's kingdom, the future heavenly government of which he was the prospective king. Thus, when before Roman governor Pontius Pilate, Jesus could say, "My kingdom is no part of this world." John 18:36. His faithful followers imitate his example by giving their loyalty to Christ and his kingdom, and by announcing that kingdom to the world.
"We are ambassadors substituting for Christ," wrote the Apostle Paul. "As substitutes for Christ, we beg, become reconciled to God."
2 Corinthians 5:20. The footnote reads, "Since Pentecost 33 CE, Christ has served as king over his congregation of anointed followers on earth. In 1914, Christ received royal authority over the kingdom of the world. Hence, anointed Christians now also serve as ambassadors of the messianic kingdom." Revelation 11:15. End of footnote. Paragraph 4, question. How have all true Christians demonstrated loyalty to God's kingdom? Because ambassadors represent a foreign sovereign or state, they do not interfere in the internal affairs of the countries where they serve. They remain neutral. Ambassadors do, however, advocate the government of the country they represent. The same is true of Christ's anointed followers, whose citizenship exists in the heavens. Philippians 3:20. In fact, thanks to their zealous kingdom preaching, they have helped millions of Christ's other sheep to become reconciled to God. These latter ones serve as Christ's envoys, as it were, in support of Jesus' anointed brothers. As one united flock advocating the messianic kingdom, both groups maintain strict neutrality toward the world's political affairs.
Isaiah 2:2-4 reads, "In the final part of the days, the mountain of the house of Jehovah will become firmly established above the top of the mountains, and it will be raised up above the hills, and to it all the nations will stream. And many peoples will go and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of Jehovah, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will instruct us about his ways, and we will walk in his paths.' For law will go out of Zion, and the word of Jehovah out of Jerusalem. He will render judgment among the nations and set matters straight respecting many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning shears. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, nor will they learn war anymore.
Paragraph 5, question. How is the Christian congregation different from ancient Israel, and how does this difference manifest itself? Loyalty to Christ is not the only reason that true Christians are neutral. Unlike ancient Israel, which had a God-given land allocation, we are part of an international brotherhood. Thus, if we were to rally to the side of local political parties, both our freeness of speech in regard to the kingdom message and our Christian unity would be severely compromised. Furthermore, during wartime, we would be fighting against fellow believers, whom we are commanded to love. With good reason, then, Jesus told his disciples to lay down the sword, and he even told them to love their enemies. Paragraph 6, question. How does your dedication to God affect your relationship with Caesar? As true Christians, we have dedicated our life to God, not to any human institution, or nation. Says 1 Corinthians 6:19 and 20, "You do not belong to yourselves, for you were bought with a price." Thus, while rendering Caesar his due in the form of honor, taxes, and relative subjection, Jesus' followers give God's things to God. Mark 12:17. This includes their worship, their whole-souled love, and their loyal obedience. If necessary, they are ready to give up their life for God.
Acts 5:29 reads, "In answer, Peter and the other apostles said, 'We must obey God as ruler rather than men.'" Romans 14:8 reads, "For if we live, we live to Jehovah, and if we die, we die to Jehovah. So both if we live and if we die, we belong to Jehovah."
The following is supplementary information. Early Christian neutrals. Secular history provides ample evidence that the early Christians remained politically neutral and refrained from warfare. Says the book, The Beginnings of Christianity, "The founders of Christianity guarded with sedulous care against the development of anything like a disposition to interfere directly with the established political order." Similarly, the book On the Road to Civilization notes, "Early Christianity was little understood and was regarded with little favor by those who ruled the pagan world. Christians refused to share certain duties of Roman citizens. They would not hold political office." Regarding the early Christians and military service, German theologian Peter Meinholt said, "Being a Christian and a soldier was considered irreconcilable." In his essay, An Inquiry into the Accordancy of War with the Principles of Christianity, religion writer Jonathan Diamond wrote that for some time after the death of Jesus, his followers refused to engage in war, whatever were the consequences, whether reproach or imprisonment or death. Diamond added, "These facts are indisputable. Only when Christianity became corrupted," said another writer, "did Christians become soldiers." Resisting the spirit of the world.
Paragraphs 7 and 8 question. What is the spirit of the world, and how is that spirit at work in disobedient humans?
Another way that Christians keep separate from the world is by resisting its evil spirit.
"We received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit that is from God," wrote Paul.
1 Corinthians 2:12.
To the Ephesians he said, "You at one time walked according to this world, according to the ruler of the authority of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience." Ephesians 2:2-3.
The world's air or spirit is an invisible impelling force that incites disobedience to God and fosters the desire of the flesh and the desire of the eyes. 1 John 2:16.
The authority of this spirit lies in its appeal to the sinful flesh, its subtlety, its relentlessness, and like air, its pervasiveness. Moreover, it is at work in disobedient humans by gradually nurturing in them ungodly traits, such as selfishness, haughtiness, greedy ambition, and the spirit of moral independence and rebellion. Simply put, the spirit of the world progressively causes the traits of the devil to grow in the hearts of humans.
Paragraph 9, question. In what ways can the world's spirit enter our mind and heart? Can the spirit of the world take root in your mind and heart? Yes, but only if you let it do so by lowering your guard.
Proverbs 4:23 reads, "Above all the things that you guard, safeguard your heart, for out of it are the sources of life."
Its influence often begins subtly, perhaps by way of associates who may appear to be good people, but in fact have no love for Jehovah. You can also absorb that evil spirit through objectionable literature, pornographic or apostate internet sites, unwholesome entertainment, and highly competitive sports. Really, through anyone or anything that conveys the thinking of Satan or his system. Paragraph 10, question. How can we resist the spirit of the world? How can we resist the insidious spirit of the world and keep ourselves in God's love? Only by taking full advantage of Jehovah's spiritual provisions and by praying constantly for Holy Spirit. Jehovah is far greater than the devil or the wicked world under satanic control. How important, then, that we stay close to Jehovah in prayer. The following is supplementary information. Am I remaining neutral?
Principle:
My kingdom is no part of this world. John 18:36. Some questions to ask yourself. How would I explain why saluting the flag is a form of idol worship? Exodus 20:4-5 and 1 John 5:21. When explaining my non-participation in certain national ceremonies, how would I show my deep respect for those who do not share my beliefs? 1 Peter 3:15. What are my reasons for not supporting any political parties or performing any type of military service? John 13:34 and 1 John 3:10-12. Being modest in our dress and grooming. Paragraph 11, question. How has the world's spirit influenced standards of dress? An outward indication of the spirit that impels a person is his dress, grooming, and hygiene. In many lands, standards of dress have fallen so low that one television commentator suggested that soon there'll be nothing left for prostitutes to wear. Even girls not yet in their teens have been caught up in this trend. Long on skin, short on modesty, said one newspaper report. Another trend is to dress in a slovenly manner that reflects a spirit of rebellion as well as a lack of dignity and self-respect. Paragraphs 12 and 13, question. What principles should govern our dress and grooming? As servants of Jehovah, we rightly want to look our best, which means dressing in a way that is neat, clean, in good taste, and appropriate for the occasion.
At all times, our appearance ought to reflect modesty and soundness of mind, which along with good works is fitting for anyone, male or female, professing devotion to God.
Of course, our main concern is not to draw attention to ourselves, but to keep ourselves in God's love. 1 Timothy 2:9-10 and Jude 21. Yes, we want our most beautiful adornment to be the secret person of the heart, which is of great value in the eyes of God. 1 Peter 3:3-4. Keep in mind, too, that our clothing styles and grooming can influence how others view true worship. The Greek word rendered modesty, when used in a moral sense, expresses the thought of reverence, awe, and respect for the feelings or opinion of others. Our goal, therefore, should be to subordinate our presumed rights to the consciences of others. Above all, we want to bring honor to Jehovah and His people, and to recommend ourselves as God's ministers, doing all things for God's glory. 1 Corinthians 10:31. Paragraph 14, question. In regard to our appearance and hygiene, what questions should we ask ourselves? Our dress, grooming, and cleanliness are even more important when we are engaging in the field ministry or attending a Christian meeting. Ask yourself, Do my appearance and personal hygiene draw undue attention to me? Do they embarrass others? Do I consider my rights in these areas to be more important than qualifying for service privileges in the congregation? Paragraph 15, question. Why does God's Word not set out a list of rules on dress, grooming, and hygiene? The Bible does not set out for Christians a list of rules on dress, grooming, and hygiene. Jehovah has no desire to deny us our freedom of choice or the use of our thinking faculties. Rather, He wants us to become mature people who reason on Bible principles
and who, through use, have their powers of discernment trained to distinguish both right and wrong.
Hebrews 5:14. Above all, He wants us to be governed by love, love for God and neighbor.
Mark 12:30 and 31 reads, "And you must love Jehovah your God with your whole heart and with your whole soul and with your whole mind and with your whole strength." The second is this: you must love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these.
Within those boundaries, there is the potential for great variety in dress and grooming. Evidence of this can be seen in the colorfully dressed, joyful throngs of Jehovah's people, no matter where on earth they are gathered.
Keeping our life simple.
Paragraph 16, question. How does the spirit of the world run contrary to Jesus' teaching? And what questions should we ask ourselves? The spirit of the world is deceptive and impels millions to look to money and material things for happiness. However, Jesus said, even when a person has an abundance, his life does not result from the things he possesses. Luke 12:15.
While not endorsing asceticism or extreme self-denial, Jesus taught that life and genuine happiness come to those who are conscious of their spiritual need and those who maintain a simple life, one that is focused on spiritual things. Matthew 5:3.
Ask yourself, do I truly believe what Jesus taught, or am I being influenced by the father of the lie? John 8:44. What do my words, my goals, my priorities, and my way of life reveal?
Paragraph 17. Name some benefits enjoyed by those who maintain a simple life.
Wisdom is proved righteous by its works, said Jesus. Matthew 11:19.
Consider just some of the benefits enjoyed by those who maintain a simple life.
They find true refreshment in kingdom service. They avoid undue anxieties and thus spare themselves much mental and emotional pain.
1 Timothy 6:9 and 10 reads, "But those who are determined to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and many senseless and harmful desires that plunge men into destruction and ruin. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of injurious things, and by reaching out for this love, some have been led astray from the faith and have stabbed themselves all over with many pains."
Content with having life's necessities, they have more time for their family and Christian companions. They may sleep better as a result. They experience the greater joy of giving, doing so in whatever way they can. And they abound in hope and have inner peace and contentment. Romans 15:13. These blessings are truly priceless. Taking up the complete suit of armor. Paragraph 18, question. How does the Bible describe our enemy, his methods, and the nature of our struggle? Those who keep themselves in God's love also enjoy spiritual protection from Satan, who wants to deprive Christians not just of happiness, but of everlasting life.
"We have a struggle," said Paul, "not against blood and flesh, but against the governments, against the authorities, against the world rulers of this darkness, against the wicked spirit forces in the heavenly places." Ephesians 6:12. The word struggle suggests that our fight is not long distance, from the safety of a hidden bunker, so to speak, but hand to hand.
Furthermore, the terms governments, authorities, and world rulers indicate that attacks from the spirit realm are highly organized and deliberate. Paragraph 19. Describe the Christian spiritual suit of armor.
Despite human frailties and limitations, however, we can gain the victory. How? By taking up the complete suit of armor from God.
Ephesians 6:13.
Describing that armor, Ephesians 6:14-18 reads, "Stand firm, therefore, with the belt of truth fastened around your waist, wearing the breastplate of righteousness, and having your feet shod in readiness to declare the good news of peace. Besides all of this, take up the large shield of faith, with which you will be able to extinguish all the wicked one's burning arrows.
Also, accept the helmet or hope of salvation, and the sword of the Spirit, that is, God's Word, while with every form of prayer and supplication you carry on prayer on every occasion in spirit." Paragraph 20, question. How does our situation differ from that of a literal soldier? Since it is a provision of God, that spiritual suit of armor will not fail us, provided that we wear it at all times. Unlike literal soldiers who may have long breaks from fighting, Christians are in a relentless life-and-death struggle that will not stop until God has destroyed Satan's world and abyssed all wicked spirits. So do not give up if you are struggling with weaknesses or wrong desires, for we all have to pummel ourselves in order to stay faithful to Jehovah.
Indeed, it is when we are not struggling that we should be concerned.
Paragraph 21, question. How only can we come off victorious in our spiritual warfare? Moreover, we cannot win this fight in our own strength. Hence, Paul reminds us of the need to pray to Jehovah on every occasion in spirit. At the same time, we should listen to Jehovah by studying His Word and associating with fellow soldiers at every opportunity, for we are not in this fight alone. Those who are faithful in all these areas will not only come off victorious, but will also be able to make a strong defense for their faith when it is challenged. Be ready to defend your faith. Paragraphs 22 and 23, question A. Why must we be ready at all times to defend our faith, and what questions should we ask ourselves? Question B. What subject will be considered in the next chapter? Because you are no part of the world, said Jesus, the world hates you. John 15:19. Christians, therefore, must always be ready to defend their faith, and to do so in a respectful, mild manner.
1 Peter 3:15 reads, "But sanctify the Christ as Lord in your hearts, always ready to make a defense before everyone who demands of you a reason for the hope you have, but doing so with a mild temper and deep respect."
Ask yourself, do I understand why Jehovah's Witnesses sometimes take a stand that is contrary to popular opinion?
When facing the challenge of taking such a stand, am I thoroughly convinced that what the Bible and the faithful slave say is right?
And when it comes to doing what is right in Jehovah's eyes, am I not only prepared to be different, but also proud to be different? Often, though, our desire to keep separate from the world is put to the test in more subtle ways. For example, as mentioned earlier, the devil tries to lure Jehovah's servants into the world by means of worldly entertainment. How can we choose wholesome entertainment that will leave us refreshed and with a clean conscience? That subject will be considered in the next chapter.